The world we know is changing. Welcome to Biotech Nation. Today on Biotech Nation, Health Prize Technologies creates strategies to get patients to take their prescribed medications, while Respire RX is working on multiple approaches to ameliorating the effects of opioids. In the medical field, it's called non-compliance. But for the rest of us, we simply say, hey, you're not taking your medications. I asked Tom Kotler, the CEO of Health Prize Technologies, is there a difference?
Just terminology. And I think part of the problem with the problem is the terminology. So let's get the terminology straight so we can talk about it here. Non-adherence is the notion of patients not taking medication as prescribed by their healthcare professional, usually their doctor, but not always. And that might be that they do one of two things. They are non-compliant or they are non-persistent. And non-compliant is not taking your medication day to day in the right way, at the right time, in the right dose. And non-persistent means you don't stay on therapy. So it means you just stop filling your medication. So you can't take a medication you've chosen not to fulfill or refill.
And those people we would know for sure because they're not going back to get their prescriptions filled.
Well, it's really fascinating because it's not so much just going back. But so, for example, part of the problem with talking about the non-adherence problem is it is not a single problem. Right? It is a variety of different problems, and it can be broken down essentially initially into three separate problems. So the first problem is called primary non-adherence. That is patients who get a script written for a medication that never fill it.
Ever.
Ever. And shockingly, depending on the medication, this is anywhere from 15 to about 35% of patients never fill the first script. And a lot of people will say, well, I don't trust my doctor. I'm not a pill person. And as my co-founder, Dr. Katrina Furlick, once wrote in one of a great blog posts, well, you're not a pill person. What are you, a disease person? But the number is shocking, and I give you a great example of it. There were some great studies done on patients discharged from the hospital post-MI. MI is a myocardial infarction or a heart attack. So these were patients who, as I say, have seen the white light at the end of the tunnel.
So they should be scared into it.
30% of them never filled their script for their CV medication after being discharged.
What's CV?
Cardiovascular medication. So
related directly to their heart.
Their heart medication, almost just north of 30% of them never filled their script for their heart medication after being discharged from the hospital after having a heart attack.
So what – I mean, what's the total impact on this? Do we have any idea? I don't know how to measure it.
It's really, really difficult to measure. But the gold standard for measurement was done by NEHI, which is the New England Healthcare Institute, in a paper they published in August of 2009 called Thinking Outside the Pill Box, wherein they estimated that the medication non-adherence problem is responsible for $290 billion, with a B, of otherwise avoidable medical spending each year in the United States alone.
$290 billion. That if they had adhered to their drugs,
would not have been expended
regimens
by the healthcare system.
That's expensive.
It is the single most expensive problem in all of healthcare. That's more than the cost of treating cancer or diabetes.
I guess another concern I have, or perhaps a greater concern I have, are for those things that, as you say, you get out of the hospital, you have a heart attack, you can die from this. You know, there are those that, well, you know, maybe this is an inconvenient chronic situation. But at other times, this can lead to premature demise.
The CDC used to measure this, but the measurement got attacked because it's really hard to do. But when they were doing it at one point, they estimated that it was the fourth greatest cause of death in the United States.
Give me some examples of what people do.
So what's really an incredible thing is we see statistics on medication non-adherence constantly, and one after the other just is virtually impossible to believe. So let me give you some examples. One of the main reasons that patients reject their transplanted organs is they don't take their immunosuppressant drugs. And these are people given a second chance of life with someone else's organ inside their body, and they don't take their medication. cancer patients don't take their medication. So, for example, women taking tamoxifen or Femara as adjuvant therapy post-chemo or radiation for their breast cancer are supposed to take a 5-year course of treatment typically. Around 60% are adherent after 1 year, and after 2 years, less than 40% are still taking their medication.
What is the psychology of this? Do people just not like to take things over time? What do we know about it?
So we know a couple of things. So let me take a step back. Historically, typically, we've looked at the medication non-adherence through two separate lenses, though we think both improper lenses. There's the lens of cost and the lens of forgetfulness. We'd like to believe that people are better than they are. So we say, oh, people forget. It's just not true. I mean, we do forget every once in a while to take a pill, but the missing of a dose once in a while is not the cause of poor outcomes that we're talking about. Really, what was we like to say, you can't remind someone to take a medication that they've chosen not to purchase. About 90% of the problem of non-adherence has been estimated to be persistence. That is, patients just don't stay on therapy. The other thing is people say, well, it costs too much. And you constantly see in the newspaper or in the general media people saying, well, they don't take their medication because it costs too much. And in fact, for some people, though not the vast majority of people, this is in fact true. However, there are copay cards and patient assistance programs and all kinds of ways to help people pay for their medication should they truly wish to take their medication. And there have been study after study after study where medication and cost has been reduced to zero. Now, this does in fact move the bar, but not very far. Typically, I'll give you a great example. Patients were in a study called the MI-free trial, and this is MI, again, MI, myocardial infarction. So patients who had a heart attack who were discharged from the hospital, and the experimental group had all their copays covered, so all their medications were free, not just their heart medication, but any other medication for a comorbid condition that they might have had. The control group, after being discharged, was sent on their merry way to do the regular thing they do with covering their copays. This covering of all the cost of the patient's medication increased adherence over a 12-month period from 39% to 44%, and that was it. And so reducing cost to zero, in fact, does increase adherence, just not by very much. And another great example is in the Netherlands, where there's lots of adherence research and no copays for any drugs of any kind. They have virtually the exact same rates of adherence as we do across indications in the United States.
Okay, what have you done?
So we've come to a couple of really, we think, important insights that we build into programs that we offer to patients through our sponsoring pharmaceutical brands. First is this. Behavioral economists call it present bias. That is, we're all wired to want things in the here and now. That short-term benefits often, almost always, trump long-term rewards. It's the same reason, for example, that very few of us save enough for retirement. It just seems a gosh darn far away that I'm going to buy that television today or go on a trip next year, and I'd rather than stick the money in the bank to save for when I'm retired and need the cash. And so it's that notion of wanting things in the here and now. It's a very human notion. Really comes from being a caveman, right? I need to worry about getting protein today. I'm not going to worry too much about saving up for a month from now and I might not even be around. Present bias is stuck in our sort of DNA, as it were. And this is a thing behavioral economists have done studies on over and over and over again. So if you're talking about taking medication to stave off a recurrence of cancer 5 years from now or a heart attack 15 years from now, let's say, it's very hard to do that day to day to day to day, stay on your medication for many people. So this notion of present bias comes into play. We overcome that by offering people in our programs benefits in the here and now, immediacy, through gamification and use of a bunch of concepts from behavioral economics in our programs.
Put them into now.
Give them something right now.
Okay. How does this work? I'm like, usually people say, and this is what our idea is. And I'm like, oh, I get it. This is what you do. It's like, I have no idea how you would get this to happen.
So we create unique digital experiences on top of our software as a service platform for our healthcare customers that they then offer to patients. And patients that enroll in these programs get weekly quizzes, weekly surveys, daily tips. We call the daily fortune cookie. We have.
Can I get frequent flyer mileage for taking my meds?
So we actually don't.
I was just going to help you there.
We actually don't.
I could do that. I'm really into my frequent flyer mileage.
So So let me answer that question in two ways. One is we don't yet connect to frequent flyer programs. So we do give points for people for getting educated, for filling their script on time, for daily self-reporting, taking their medication, and doing other things related to their general well-being. So it is like a loyalty program for taking your meds. We don't yet connect directly to mileage programs, but we're working on it. I would say, secondly, what's really fascinating, I don't know how often.
Take your meds, take a trip. You'll be alive, for starters.
There you go. Right? You get something to look forward to, so you got to take
your
meds.
This is really good.
So what's really fascinating is if you look at people who could afford to take as many free flights as they wish to, but they will often actually – senior executives at companies, I don't know about you more, but people will actually take an airline flight that would be somewhat inconvenient versus the most convenient flight for the sole purpose of getting more points on their airline miles. They will inconvenience themselves. My co-founder, Katrina Furlick, who is a former neurosurgeon, tells a great story. She used to live in a town in Connecticut called New Canaan, which is a pretty upscale town. And there's a Baskin Robbins in town, and they give away twice a year free coupons for an ice cream. And the line is down the street on Main Street in New Canaan with, doctors and lawyers and hedge fund guys.
Gotta get my free ice cream.
They could buy the darn Baskin Robbins, the whole thing, probably the whole company, forget the whole franchise. And they're waiting in line to get a free scoop of ice cream. Or go to – I'm here in San Francisco for bio. Lots of physicians and scientists here. If you had a booth that gave away free T-shirts – there'd be a line a mile long for a free $4 T-shirt. The power of free is this amazing thing. I mean, what people will do to get something for free.
And get a value. They get value.
Well, the funny part is they actually lose value, right? So that guy waiting in line with his daughter – now, he may – and most of those guys, by the way, don't like waiting in line for anything. But waiting in line with his daughter might get the value of actually spending some extra time with his daughter. But he's losing value. And you think about it. If you spend a half an hour in that line and you build $500 an hour at your job, you just paid $250 to get an ice cream cone.
Well, it all works in so many funny ways because everybody's motivated by different things.
Exactly.
It's like I remember saying to my then teenage son, you mean I just paid for you to fly all the way to Europe and you didn't sign up for the darn mileage program?
Yeah.
You're
right.
Making me crazy. You were halfway
right
to a free trip, you know?
And to that point, and that's a great point.
But that was me.
Well, here's the thing, right? So he didn't care about that.
No.
He cared about something else.
What does he care
so
about?
So one of the things that we have historically done in medication adherence intervention programs is we've always said, well, it's cost or forgiveness. So I'm going to remind you, or I'm going to reduce your cost. And those are relatively simple one-trick ponies. And they do, in fact, move the bar. They don't move it very far. And for some people, they don't move it at all. But they're one-trick ponies. If you get tired of that one trick, there's really nothing left in that intervention to actually motivate you to do the right thing for yourself. So what we've done at Health Prize is we've taken a real kitchen sink approach. So to your point, so we have quizzes.
What else can you do for me?
We have quizzes and surveys and competitions and sweepstakes and leaderboards and all kinds of different little hooks to get people to get educated about the reason it's important for them to take their medication. And so you don't get tired of doing it. We've run programs in diabetes, hypertension, high cholesterol, psoriasis, acne, asthma, COPD. We're running programs in a bunch of specialty indications now. HIV. We're building a program in HIV right now. A program for hemophilia patients.
There's problems in adherence in HIV.
Huge problems.
Tell me, because we're down to one pill a day.
It's called an SDR, a single daily regimen, and patients don't take them. It's shocking because in the 1980s we had lots of AIDS patients fighting to their death for pills to be created and drug cocktails to be released that would,
20, 25,
that would extend
30
their
pills
lives.
A day, not uncommon.
Oh, it had to be right on time. You had to live with the clock. Now it's take one pill once a day, and adherence rates are very, very bad. And there are studies in HIV which suggest that if you're less than 90% adherent, you're better off not taking the drug because you will, for yourself and for the HIV community, create resistance that is bad for the population as a whole.
Now, I heard you say something that sounded like the end game was education, that somehow
it is.
Why?
It is.
I already know it's going to be good for me.
You do, and then you don't. So let me give you a great example. We ran a program in high cholesterol, and we do a lot with trying to educate people because behavioral economists will tell you that one of the reasons we make really bad decisions is lack of data.
We just don't know.
That's right. And so they call them heuristics or sort of shortcuts because we have to make so many decisions so frequently that we just don't have the data we need to make good decisions, so we make poor decisions. That's one of the reasons, and there are lots of others. In this case, so for example, we did a program with patients with high cholesterol, and most patients with high cholesterol do not know that high cholesterol is a risk factor for stroke, not just heart attack. And what we found out by taking quizzes and surveys with people in this program was that, in fact, very few of them knew this, and most of them were much more afraid of stroke than they were of a heart attack. And the reason is you don't see somebody or the effects of someone who's had a heart attack, whereas you see a stroke patient walking down the street with a cane or having lost control of their facial muscles and maybe having slurred speech, and you just don't want to be that person. And so once we
– That's a powerful motivator.
So once we found this out through quizzes and surveys and what we call our daily fortune cookie, which is a daily health tip, we hammered home the point to these patients in this program that risk that high cholesterol was a significant risk factor, not just for heart attacks but for strokes. At the end of the study, over 90% of the people got the quiz questions right about stroke and high cholesterol, and almost every patient in that program became more adherent to their medication as a result.
Tom Kotler is the CEO of HealthPrize Technologies. More information is available at healthprize.com. While we've been talking about people taking their medications, the current opioid epidemic points to problems with some of the medications themselves. There are now 200 million opioid prescriptions issued in the United States, and there's been 30,000 deaths. I asked Dr. Arnold Lippa, Chief Scientific Officer of RespireRx, if the opioid epidemic is a recent phenomenon or if it's been brewing for a while.
There's been a dramatic increase over the last 5 or 6 years, but it's always been an issue. It's just received public attention lately because we've seen so many celebrities, not just Prince, but Michael Jackson, who died of a propofol overdose, but also causing respiratory depression. That's the major reason people die. You see, when you're taking opiates, for instance, say oxycodone, when you first start, you take a dose of 5 milligrams and it alleviates your pain. You have to go up to 50 milligrams before it starts suppressing your breathing. And if you keep going, you'll ultimately stop breathing. As you become tolerant to the drugs, which happens relatively quickly, you need more and more of the drug to reduce your pain. But tolerance doesn't develop so much to the respiratory depressant effects. So after several weeks, a month, you're now taking 20, 30, 40 milligrams of oxycodone, and you're right at the border there of starting to get respiratory depression. And it's very easy to fall over that threshold, and now You're in trouble.
Now, what does RespireRx do in this area?
We're developing a class of drugs called ampicons. Ampicons work by boosting the actions of a neurotransmitter in the brain called glutamate. Glutamate's the major excitatory transmitter in the brain. And the work is derived from a scientist at the University of Alberta who's worked with the company and really conducted a beautifully elegant piece of translational research. And it basically originates with the discovery that there are certain cells in the brain that act as pacemakers for breathing. If you knock out the cells, you knock out breathing. Those cells contain receptors for opiates, for barbiturates and anesthetics, And when the drugs act on those receptors, the cells slow down their firing and your breathing slows down. If you take too much, the cells stop firing, your breathing stops. Counteracting the effects of these depressant drugs, there are receptors for glutamate. The glutamate is excitatory, so it counteracts the effects of the drugs. And so now we've taken these ampicons, which boost glutamate, and find that they counteract the effects of these drugs, whether they're opiates or propofol, which is what killed Michael Jackson. They work at the level of the cell. They work in animals. And we have two studies that have been conducted showing they work in people. So that's what translational research is. You find a site of action, you develop drugs, and you bring it all the way up to human research.
Now, this is very interesting in the sense that it's not like opioids are all bad. We need a lot of these opioids.
You know, I give a lecture and I tell this story. Every good story needs a villain. The villain in this case is the Greek god Morpheus, which is where the word morphine derives from. So Morpheus is the god of sleep and dreams, and he's usually depicted as one side white and one side black. So the white side, the good side, gives you pleasant dreams. He takes away your pain. The dark side of Morpheus can literally take away your breath. The opiates are still the most effective analgesics that we have, but they come with a whole host of problems. And we're trying to deal with some of those problems to make opiates safer.
Is the idea to give a second pill or a second injection?
Well, there are a number of ways of doing it, depending on the indication. We've identified a few. One indication is during surgery, because what are the drugs they use for anesthesia? They use fentanyl. Anybody who's had colonoscopy has gotten fentanyl. An anesthesiologist typically gives you a big slug of fentanyl. Your breathing slows down. They know it's working. Great measure.
Yeah.
We envision an intravenous formulation for that that can be given in conjunction with either propofol or fentanyl. We also envision it to be used in a post-surgical setting. What happens when you come out of anesthesia? They give you a little button and you get IV morphine. Well, there's a reason why that button stops working after a while, because they worry about respiratory depression. It's not always effective, but they can't give you anymore. And now we have a way of making the drug safer. The third use that we're looking at is a proprietary formulation in conjunction with an opiate. So say we could take a long-acting oxycodone, combine it with one of our ampicons, and now when you start taking 20, 30, 40 milligrams, you're not going to get the respiratory depressant effects. And we can make it safer for the millions of people who are taking opiates. What's interesting is if you look at the opiate deaths, the 30,000, the public view is that, well, these, you know, they're junkies. They're heroin addicts. The fact is they're not. The majority of these people are people who are taking prescription meds given by a physician, and they just accidentally overdose because the drugs can be dangerous.
Dr. Arnold Lippa is the Chief Scientific Officer of RespireRx. More information is available at RespireRx.com. For Biotech Nation, I'm Moira Gunn.
Tech Nation and its regular segment Biotech Nation are produced at the studios of KQED-FM in San Francisco. Executive producer is Matt Gardner. The director of technical production is Monte Carlos. And audio engineers include Howard Gelman, Seal Mahler, and Larry Upton. Our theme music was composed by Ann Nachtrieb-Zesiger and Robert Powell, with title creation provided by NameLab Incorporated of San Francisco. Program information and internet audio is available on the web at technation.com. Tech Nation and Biotech Nation are productions of Tech Nation Media. I'm Paul Landcorf.